But there is a connection. I will figure it out one day between speculative metaphysics and communism. I do believe they're organically linked. One day I will understand it.
I'm rooting for you, man.
Yeah, good luck, brother.
What's up, everyone?
Yo.
For this episode, we decided to read a little classic by Perry Anderson titled Considerations on Western Marxism from 1976. Francis Roy Peregrine Perry Anderson is a Marxist historian. He survives his almost as well-known historian brother, Benedict Anderson, who wrote Imagined Communities, Reflections on the Origin and Spread of Nationalism in 1983. Other notable works include Passages from Antiquity to Feudalism, Lineages of the Absolutist State, Arguments with English Marxism, and In the Tracks of Historical Materialism, the last of which further develops the themes that began in Considerations. And he has a bunch of other books, too. Anderson was the editor of the New Left Review for 20 years. I think he still does that. He played a role in the process of the New Left beginning to take stock of its legacy, some of which we will discuss today. And he continues to influence the New Left Review as well as write for the London Review of Books. Some people consider it a rite of passage to have been excoriated by Anderson in their pages, called the Perry Anderson treatment, if they are to be taken seriously by the effete echelons of the academic left. And I think not all survive this treatment. Considerations.
I dream of this happening to me.
Considerations on Western Marxism is, in my opinion, or at least the sense I had about it, was that it was strange to read in 2023 because it was a little bit hard to believe that it's 50 years old. It introduces debates about the intellectual legacy of Western Marxism that were hardly passed and that I think, I don't know, speaking frankly, I don't think we've much resolved. The basic idea is that the themes, preoccupations, and intellectual impulses of Western Marxism emerged after what Anderson calls the classical period of Marxism, which was primarily Eastern in its orientation. And I kind of want to emphasize that because I think when we think about Western Marxism, people tend to think the Russian tradition and the Russian Revolution in the Eastern Bloc and Poland and or even East Prussia, that was the West. And I think that is a sort of artificial construction that is only in keeping with the more recent trend of thinking about Europe as a whole, as the West. But for most of Europe's history, and at least during its early industrial development, that was simply not true. And there was this really rather strong difference between the East and West this in development and culture, and so on and so forth. So one of the things he points out is that actually the political tradition, the classical tradition of Marxism, was really an Eastern phenomenon. That was where it flourished, and not in the West, where we tend to think about it now in Italy, France, and Germany. And most importantly, the big cultural and political difference was that when the Marxist tradition wasn't to be found in the university, and it was instead in cadre schools, party schools, and political debates that prompted urgent theorizing about economic development, social structure, the state, internationalism, imperialism, and class struggle. He argues that the main figures of Western Marxism, like Lukács, Sartre, Althusser, Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse, and the rest of the cast that you probably know, were people whose ideas were shaped in defeat and who had little to no knowledge of the classical tradition and who were all, with Gramsci as the only exception and awkward bridge between generations, chairs of philosophy at a university. Provocatively, Anderson writes that the progressive relinquishment of economic and political structures as the central concerns of theory was accompanied by a basic shift in the whole center of gravity of European Marxism toward, and then in italics, philosophy. And he means that literally.
Derogatory.
The tradition became obsessed with method, pre-Marxian philosophical influences and the early works of Marx that were more philosophical in nature, but that Marx himself never published as works of philosophy. They were therefore relating more to the bourgeois thought and social science at the time, and probably still continue to do so through the 80s and 90s and early aughts, insofar as Marxism survived at all in the academy, more so than they were relating to socialist thought and social science, since bourgeois thought was still dynamic in the post-war period and socialist thought was increasingly not. Anderson also points out that the national intellectual traditions in Italy, Germany, and France became increasingly provincial and unaware of one another. This essay is somewhat ethnographic rather than analytical, but I think it's really useful for analytical reasons. There's something so obviously true about the thematic shifts that follow the formal shifts and who is doing theory and why. In a way, it's a kind of ideological critique of professional intellectuals and professorial socialists who the likes of Kautsky, Lenin, Luxembourg, Trotsky, and Bukharin would have scorned, even if some of them likewise came from the middle class. But it forces us to ask, or at least it forced me to ask, what if some of the philosophical problems that plague myself and my peers are just that, philosophical problems for philosophers? For instance, the classical tradition had no problem having international debates about development and imperialism and war. Now we debate whether Marxism is simply a Western paradigm or implicitly nationalist in orientation. Why would that be? Classical Marxists were obsessed by the bourgeois state, but now we accuse Marxism of economic reductionism and a constitutive failure to think politically. So my question, I guess, is whose problems are these really? And if we can be a little self-indulgent, what does that say about what's left of philosophy?
That's nice. The name of the show.
Oh, shit.
I've heard of that place before. Okay, I'll start on a more personal note, like reading this. One, Owen kind of expresses, so this isn't only me, but starting to feel called out while reading this.
Yeah, my God. I'm just like, 100%.
I love myself a little philosophy, and when he talked about, you know, the shift to the focus on method, I was like, oh no.
Damn.
That's like what I really liked.
And then he names off like five of my favorite books, and it's like, look at this, like, look at all this method obsessed people. Like,
we're getting the Anderson treatment right now.
Totally admired.
From decades ago, he's reading us for filth.
Yeah.
Well, I guess a cool place to start is this idea that, you know, he's working through of, you know, one's connection to political organization or, you know, the sort of outside the academy, you know, disciplining of Marxism affects the themes. And I thought that was, you know, really interesting and rich, where he's describing that this cadre of figures that he's describing, and Lillian already said their names, so I won't repeat them, like Althusser, Sartre, and all of that, found themselves faced with the choice of either becoming a part of a disciplined organization, which, because organizations are this way, would constrain the sort of philosophical creativity and experimentation they were trying to introduce into Marxism, or, you know, resign themselves to isolation and thus, you know, maybe increase the philosophical creativity at the cost of actually, you know, analyzing, you know, empirical social relations. And so I guess, you know, I'm wondering what you all think about at least one premise of Anderson's argument seems to be not just your location, but who you're in conversation with will affect the content of the Marxism that you get and, you know, where it's directed. I find that plausible, but I was wondering what you all made of this choice between disciplinary organization outside the academy or isolation. Mm-hmm. And near the end of the book, he starts talking about a theme of this type of Marxist thought is pessimism, mm-hmm. You know, the experience of defeat and isolation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also felt pretty singled out or called out. The shift to method, the shift to cultural analysis and criticism away from hard economic reality.
Or from socialism. Yeah, that's the part. Yeah.
I mean, there's a way in which the story that he tells just has like immediate plausibility to me when he gives this sort of account of what did it look like in the post-war period for this, you know, this series of Western Marxist thinkers. And yeah, you had on the one hand, you could not completely sever the tie between theory and practice by joining one or more of the communist parties or social democratic parties that existed at the time. But those were being forced due to like orthodoxy to, you know, basically toe a Stalinist party line, so that, you know, the organic unity of that theory practice connection was already actually severed too. It made it impossible to do any actual clear-eyed political thinking, or you needed to like couch your analyses in ways that wouldn't be offensive, or just to just be in isolation from that, like explicitly, right? Like, you know, in more and more and less like obvious ways. By the time we get to like in Adorno for me is like the apex of this, right? Like with Adorno, first of all, what does he ever say about politics ever? What does he ever say about economics ever? You read something like Negative Dialectics and it's like, I guess he's talking about exchange society, but like, what the fuck is that? You know, what are we talking about? Does it have any actual relationship specifically to capitalism? And like, yeah, it kind of hits hard.
It's certainly highly mediated.
It's certainly highly mediated. And it hits pretty hard when Anderson's like, yeah, and of course they're all like professors of philosophy. And it's like, right. Yeah.
I mean, that part was kind of shocking. It's like they were all without exception professors of philosophy. And then you're like, oh.
Chairs, yeah.
Oh.
Uh-oh, yeah. Whoops, uh-oh.
And that's part of why they went from having like a direct organic connection with like workers' movements to speaking what he calls an enciphered language, which is what happened.
Quote, at an increasingly remote distance from the class whose fortunes it formally sought to serve or articulate.
That's right.
Pretty deep burn. Yeah.
Though I will say, you know, and he does acknowledge this, that, you know, Sartre is also a kind of weird example.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I remember, you know, Sartre, yes, he's trained in philosophy, but he didn't end up, you know, teaching philosophy. He became, you know, that engaged writer and public intellectual and all of that. Sartre is a weird example because, yes, on the one hand, when you read, if you read Being and Nothingness, yeah. Jargon all over the place. No, fuck it. Critique of Dialectical Reason.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Jargon and all of that. But, you know, Sartre also explicitly tried to think through, well, how does one remain engaged with, you know, on the ground struggles and all that? And I think the most classical example is, you know, his activism around the Algerian War, France's war in Algeria. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
He was also a master of mobilizing different mediums and formats for writing, right? So one of the things that makes him, I think, super unique as a philosopher is that he was an incredibly good journalist in terms of writing journalistic style articles about the Algerian War, for example, that became like really influential. And then pamphlets and plays and novels and just like a massive array of media. But he's singular in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I kept returning to was there's two things. First, it was striking to me how Anderson describes, for example, Sartre as having not a lot of familiarity with the Marxist tradition. And I find this is true a lot. Yeah. Like, I hope, like, you know, I hope no one feels called out who listens to this too much. I'm just, like, making an observation. The lack of familiarity with the practical tradition of Marxism that I have experienced intellectually, in academia, and in philosophy is very, very acute. So, like, there's some people who are like really like classical Marxism heads and they've read everything, and I'm not one of those people, but I've read a great deal of the classical tradition. And I've found myself thinking, like, at what point do people think that they learned this stuff? Because Marxism kind of haunts philosophy and the social sciences in this way that I now find even more perplexing than I did before, because I used to think that it was like, I'm trying to find the words to say this, people like kind of read secondhand about Marx, or their professors who kind of like used to be radical, and so they kind of use it as a foil for themselves throughout their whole life, but like kind of always in this like disavowing way. Now I'm realizing that the ignorance actually might be more profound than that. Like, if Sartre didn't really know much about it, then why would I expect any of the teachers I ever had to know much about it? And so there's this way in which the specter of Marxism that haunts both social philosophy and social science becomes increasingly peculiar if that's true. I used to think it was bad faith, let me put it that way, or posturing graduate students. Mm. But if it's actual ignorance in many places, then I feel like there's a whole sociological world that I don't quite understand. And then the second thing that really stood out to me is when he says that what happened here was the reduction of space for theoretical work to the constricted alternatives of institutional obedience or individual isolation, crippling any possibility of a dynamic relationship between historical materialism and socialist struggle, and precluded any direct development of the main themes of classical Marxism. I don't know what I want to say about that, but the perception is that Marxism is the thing that's narrow. I'm obsessed with this. You guys know this, or our audience knows this. Marxism is what's narrow. Anderson is saying that it is the inverse, that what happened to it in the academy is what's narrow. I think that's crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm like very struck by this whole thing.
One thing to say about that is that I think you're right that he's saying that it's Western Marxism that's narrow. And this is for a couple of reasons. I mean, I also want to say that, like, there are moments in this text, and we'll hopefully get to them, where I want to push back a little bit and be like, okay, it's not all trash, right? And he even admits himself, like, in the afterword, he's like, this is very polemical. I'm, you know, painting in a brush. And also, he, by the way, says in the afterword, don't think that what I'm advocating for is a kind of just, like, uncritical, like activist philosophical orientation. Like, that would just, like, quick, like, solve the problem, right? These guys were just sitting in the ivory tower. If only they had, like, actually involved. Been, like, it, like, sitting in a strike or something. That's too quick of a conclusion to draw. But one thing that I think is true is that, like, what is the object of Marxism is maybe a good question to ask here. And it seems like in the classical tradition, in the classical Marxists, you know, your Korsch, Luxemburg, sometimes Gramsci, certainly Engels and like Hilferding and all this, it's capitalism. It is, you know, the critique of political economy. It is these questions of, like, political and social relations, the state, imperialism, et cetera. And in a lot of what we now think of as Marxism in its, like, Western or, like, academicized version, the object of Marxism is Marxism.
Yeah, Marxism.
It's Marx. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right? Well, where, like, it's just this sort of endless discursive meditation on and reflection on, like,
just one more reading text. Of Marx.
Just one more good reading sir. Of Marx. Exactly.
Because that's and, what like, stands in the I, way of us and a better future is just one more really good reading of Marx.
We're so close to cracking the labor theory of value.
I know, oh right? Exactly.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no. And like, it's one of those questions that I think Marxist or leftist thinkers always need to ask themselves is like, what is the point of this work that I'm doing right now? Because like, if the point is like to get quote Marx right, because good news, now we have greater access to the archives and I can like test this against like the new leaflet of a chapter from the Grundrisse and like I'll know that I got Marx right, like that kind of doesn't fucking matter. The question is, does it like describe the world correctly? Mm-hmm. Do we ever get past this kind of hermeneutic echo chamber to like talk about the real political shit that's actually meant to be the motivating stakes?
Does it get the world right, or does it also like potentiate political practice in new ways or frame it in new ways that might have traction outside of Marxist theory? That's the other thing, right? There's the explanatory part, and then there's the practical side. And both were intimately connected in that generation of Marxists that with like Luxembourg and Lukács and Gramsci.
I actually am feeling kind of the polemical spirit as well. Like what you just said there, Gil and Owen, I don't know, for some reason that just felt really clarifying for me. So on the one hand, you even have what Lillian just says that, you know, it actually might turn out that a lot of these generations of philosophers don't even understand or have read much Marx. So there's, you know, it's not even the object is to get Marx right. They're using a very caricatured notion of Marx that is used there as a way of saying, so forget about that capitalism stuff, or at least forget about how we think Marx talked about capitalism, junk that whole enterprise and all of that. But I also am, you know, warm to the idea that, you know, maybe something that's peculiar to the dynamics of philosophy, and maybe Marx did kind of have our number on this, is that it is in many ways an interpretive enterprise and all of that. So the object is often either specific arguments that are written down or specific figures. And so the idea that, you know, the point of Marxism is to simply repeat and say what Marx said over and over again that does miss it. Now, you might think getting what Marx said correct allows you to do the thing of explaining political economy, capitalist dynamics, etc. But, you know, when Gil is talking, the polemical thing I was thinking is I do sometimes worry about a type of analysis that offers itself as radical, but is actually a form of sort of what I would call, polemically again, Marxist conservatism, where all the arguments bottom out in, well, as Marx said, or Marx, you know, never said that, or Marx didn't agree, which is not to say that Marx isn't smarter than me. I get it. But if the point is to understand and change the world, and the point is not to understand and develop one more reading of Marx in order to sling against your opponents, I mean, that will make a difference. And so we could say that maybe there's a tendency in philosophy of continuing to withdraw from the what Owen called the explanatory and the practical to an overemphasis on the hermeneutical and the interpretive, you know,
the epistemological,
naming your reading of Marx, the new Marx reading, the Althusserian Marxism, the Hegelian. I could go on and on and on. And it seems like something is missing there. Mm. And it's not to say that there hasn't been fruitful research, but it strikes me, basically what I wanted to say is, if we knew that we could change the world in a proper direction and that would require doing things that go outside of things explicitly Marx said, we should be about that, I imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, Marx isn't the limit and he isn't the point of the political project. He is a historical figure who got something that a lot of us think he got right. And that's why we're interested in what he said, not simply because he's Karl Marx.
I will say, like, in partial defense of the bad turn, the academicism and the epistemology emphasis, I get why, right? Like, I get why so many of these thinkers wound up doing, like he says, this is the line from the chapter on formal shifts. He says that the result is a remarkable amount of the output of Western Marxism became a prolonged and intricate discourse on method, right? It's a discourse on method. Mm-hmm. And, like, I want to just, like, apologetically say in these thinkers' defense that, like, I get why you'd want to, like, try to do a discourse on Marxian method, because, like, Marx was able to do something really remarkable, right? And really different than everything that came before, right? Like, you know, sometimes there's this, like, really simplistic way of being like, oh, well, Marx just kind of, like, synthesized what? French politics, German philosophy, and, like,
British political economy.
And British political economy. And it's like, well, I mean, first of all, it's not really obvious or clear what it would look like just to, like, synthesize those straightforwardly. And, like, you can't just add those up and get Marx or Capital, right? You don't just get that. So
it is a great mix, though, I got to say.
It's a pretty banger mix. There's a lot going on there, a lot to say for it, right? But, like, he did do something different. And I get looking around and being like, okay, the conjuncture has changed. Things are not the way that they were when in the 1850s Marx is doing his analysis of capitalism and his critique of political economy. I want to know how to do what Marx did today. And it makes certain kind of sense to be like, okay, let's figure out what his methodological approach was to try to figure out what it would look like to redeploy it today. Now, like, I think Anderson's right that there's a certain point at which the discourse on method becomes, like, interminable. And, you know, you never actually get to that next step of, like, doing conjunctural
actually
analysis.
Doing it.
Actually doing it. But I wanted to just say, like, I get the temptation there.
Yeah. Just as a bit of context, so I like that he describes the way that we got to this place where Marxism, every Marxist, great Marxist text becomes like a discourse on method, is it's the reverse trajectory of Marx's own like life trajectory, where Marx went from philosophy and method, right, to politics, to economics, and we did the exact opposite. We went from a Marxism that it's embedded in theories of economics and politics, like, and we ended up at philosophy, and we're sticking around there.
Yeah. What I find, you know, really bracing in Anderson's reading is, one, yeah, there is the polemics, but I also sense that the way to read the text isn't to say, like, he's blaming Althusser or Sartre or anything like that. I think he's also trying to detail the historical conditions that made it possible for this rift to emerge.
Mm. Yeah.
And those conditions were defeat and fragmentation and a lack of engagement with other traditions. Like, it's fascinating. I love the part where he's just like, you know, it turns out actually, you know, Althusser didn't really know much about what Sartre was writing. Sartre didn't really understand much about what Adorno was writing, and yet they're all lobbing bombs at each other.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I also think that there's a way that he sets up that opposition of, you know, is either submit to the discipline, the sort of the Stalin dictates from the USSR, or isolation. But going into the university, that's surely another form of submitting to a type of discipline.
Totally.
And I think this might be a chance to talk about the kind of disciplinary constraints that philosophy places on thought. I mean, I do wonder, since our podcast is called What's Left of Philosophy, will there be a role left for philosophy? Like, so we're getting the regressive elements, or at least the distorting elements in particular historical conditions of how philosophy increasingly lost the object that, you know, Marx or Marxist thought was winning, which is, you know, the political and the economic. But, you know, does this mean simply break with philosophy? Where does this leave, you know, the role of philosophy given the constraints of the academy?
You know, I think it's really helpful for you to say that it's submitting to another kind of discipline, because, and for that reason, it's sort of fecund in, I think, what Anderson wants to say is a narrow way, because he says that the other kind of discipline, like of the, like the Soviet intellectual climate, he doesn't find particularly fecund, but it's clear that that's also a kind of discipline. So I think what he wants to say is, like, it depends on who your interlocutors are. And if there's a problem here, it's not being aware that that's happening to you. So, like, you know, there's these debates that people online have and in publications about, like, the professional middle class and so on. People get really, from my perception, people get really aggravated if you tell them they're part of the PMC and they have interests or, like, intellectual stakes and arguments that are basically germane to that milieu. I have to be honest, I'm not sympathetic to that at all. I'm very okay with the PMC being a kind of, like, making a problem out of it, because I am middle class. I'm a professor. I don't understand the point in saying that I'm not. I hardly ever talk to working class people. The last time, like, I was in regular conversation with working class people was probably, you know, when I worked a regular job in New York or Chicago, or my family, you know, who are all retired, or when I go to the pub. But it's like, class segregation is so severe, and people seem so threatened by pointing that out. I genuinely don't understand this. I think that if you care about politics, or you think working class people are part of your constituency, then that kind of self-awareness is just not, it's just not a threat. It's a problem to be understood. But my sense is that people really react very viciously against this, and I have a little bit of contempt for that at this point, because it's like, if you don't see the vast separation between most professors' lives and most people's lives, I just don't know what you're talking about. Like, it means I don't, you know, I just don't trust your what you're doing, to be honest. So that's one thing. So maybe part of why this hits home is that it forces you to stop play acting and LARPing. Like, you live lives that are more analogous to even the ones Sartre or Althusser lived in. Like, Sartre was living a political life that we don't live.
His apartment was firebombed over the French-Algerian War. My apartment isn't.
Yeah, like, you know what I mean? So there's a sense, there's a way in which philosophers can inhabit mental worlds that are not theirs. And that's a part of the beauty of it. I mean, that's what I find, like, genuinely inspiring. But there's also a gross potential for self-delusion in this process. And I think, like, this kind of text helps me think about a problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that this exercise of, like, trying to understand one's, like, class position, where one's embedded, how it informs one philosophically, and the actual connection between, I don't know, audiences that you might want to reach or places that you want your ideas to go and where they're actually going to go and what they're doing. Like, that's something that is not, I think it's important to note that that's not something that is, like, a side political or moral concern of philosophy. I mean, it's a question that it's not a tangential, like, question for philosophy. And I think that's really, really clear in this book. What really comes through is that, just at a broader level, not even just about Marxism, but about philosophy in general, is that it has to answer to these kinds of pressures. It has to, as best it can, become aware of those pressures as well and work through them in order to do philosophy well and meaningfully. You know what I mean? It isn't something to do with like, well, because there's a lot of people that, you know, there's I can't remember this guy's name. There's some guy who kind of, he wrote this paper and it's been, I don't know, circulating a little bit online about how like philosophers shouldn't say anything about politics basically, or shouldn't care about politics, and it actually corrupts philosophy engage with that. There's a lot of people, and I, you know, I don't want to be too like prejudiced here, but it's probably like the vast majority of the analytic tradition, and you know, I still probably most of the continental tradition, that think that it is like somehow it's some side concern that isn't directly related to philosophy. And that's just not true of like the great historical philosophers. You think Hegel didn't have like tons of shit to say about Germany at his time and understand the way that the work he was doing was embedded within like contemporary historical developments? It's the same thing with Plato. It's the same thing with Spinoza. It was excommunicated on political grounds. And like all these like philosophical greats that we like to hold up and say, well, they were all like deeply political. Marx was the first to come along and understand exactly the like the determinative relationship between those practical concerns and like theoretical work.
Two weird things. You know, I'll say the first weird things. What Lillian was saying about, you know, how people react to the whole PMC thing and try to say like, no, actually, I really am one of the wretched of the earth. If you take some really roundabout hermeneutical paradigm, you can get there. I sometimes wonder if this is a place to kind of, you know, go check out our psychoanalysis episode. Like, I feel like psychoanalysis could provide an interesting explanatory paradigm of repression and guilt going on here, a constant movement of disavowal of something that you know, but you don't want to actually
express
it, you
know? That's well
which
put.
Is this difference, and it shows that your public countenance really departs from your interior, etc. So that was just one thing I wanted to say about the idea that I wonder if there's like the type of guilty conscience happening in philosophy.
Hilarious.
That either is, you know, what Lillian described as LARPing, or what Owen was describing as, you know, almost repressing the political and saying, obviously the political is a contaminant of philosophy. The second question I wanted to ask with the Perry Anderson is, okay, so all four of us are trained in philosophy, so I'm wondering what you all think. Is there something distinctive about philosophy that this is a problem? For instance, Perry Anderson doesn't say, well, maybe it's because he didn't end up in English departments, but he doesn't say English or... what are other
sociology?
See, this is how much of a narcissist I'm. I'm like, what are the
what other
disciplines
exist? Are there any other disciplines?
But you know, is there something particular about the, and notice I didn't even go back. I'm just pretending that
we're gonna just move on.
There's
that's
English.
Fine. Sure, whatever.
Is
English
there something
exists.
Distinctive
like history.
About the practice of philosophy that, you know, one can be seduced into this type of LARPing, but also repressing politics? Like, is there something about philosophy that wants to connect with what Marxism or Marx is doing and is constantly recoiling back from? Because I wonder, why do philosophers take themselves so seriously on this front of not being contaminated by the world and yet wanting to be like, no, but we really have something to say?
You know why? Because, well, no, I don't know why, but I can say that what other disciplines, like I'm in a political science department now, and that kind of like anxious self-awareness, I don't see it. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Shout out to my colleagues. Just kidding.
y'all are real
all
ones.
Very smart people. But there's not really a lot of like pretenses about like the truth seeking and the whole thing. Like there people are cool with like mid-range truth. The era of like the big sociological theories is over, and like it just seems like people want to accomplish what they can within their limits. The thing that people ask me almost every time I meet them is like, is there any empirical dimension to your work, or is it, and I quote, just theoretical? So they have a pretty low opinion about like doing things that don't have that kind of mid-range humility.
I just do the Queen of the Sciences. That's it.
Yeah. Word. That's
gonna
be my
from
now on. Like,
that rocks.
I just do Queen shit. I don't really.
Sorry, peons.
Really fuck with the peon shit. Yeah.
But I do think that there is something dispositionally different about what a philosopher, when you decided to get serious about it, like wanted to achieve. Mm-hmm. And even if you end up being smaller and more humble in your wisdom and age, the impulse is different, I think.
There's like a really funny line in one of Adorno's texts on Hegel where he says, "The Science of Logic is one of the rare books from the canon where on any given page, you might not only not know what he's talking about, you might not know if there is something that he's talking about." And I think that this
powerful.
Is a kind of, yeah. And I think that this is something that philosophy, to go to this question about like, why is this like anxious sort of self-awareness or lack of self-awareness, like specific to philosophy, philosophers like don't even have any sort of agreement about what it is that the object of philosophy is. We don't have like if I studied English, no one's like, "What's that about?" It's like, "Oh, it's about English literature. It's about language." Like, come on. If I studied like history or political theory, like it's just not a question if there is even a thing that this is about. Whereas like philosophy kind of, that's a question. That's an open question. And again, if you put 10 philosophers into a room, you're going to get 11 different answers to that question, right?
Yeah, the homeboy who's in the argument with himself.
Yeah, there's at least one guy who's arguing with himself, or he's like, it's actually two things because of dialectics or whatever. So I think that it like this is part of like the source of the anxiety. And also, let's be super honest, right? Just for a second, philosophy as an academic discipline in terms of producing like work with results that is like effective, bad track record, especially for the past century. Not great, I think we can all agree. And so there's this need to then
when
be like,
"No, we have had effects." They haven't been great.
It makes sense then that like professional philosophers would be like, "No, I insist this is definitely about something. I am connected to something real. This is like for sure not just like, I don't know, endless textual hermeneutics with no clear goal, object, or like orientation."
Man, I got to be honest. Like, but you know, so again, I hate this mirror.
By the way, this while I am trying to become a professor of philosophy, by the way.
To be clear, I can't wait till this episode's over so I can forget that I read Perry Anderson. But okay, so here, anyone who knows me, well, at least my public persona, like the
what
thing
is
that
Will's
I love about philosophy
persona?
Is, yeah, let me tell you all what my public persona is, because a lot of y'all misunderstand.
Uh-oh.
So I'm going to tell you what I am. I just am, and Lillian kind of said this, I just love examining arguments. And so sometimes I think what makes philosophy distinctive is the argument. You know, we're the ones who do arguments, and believe me, you know, we don't always talk about it openly, but we often do. We look at other departments, they're like, they're trying to do arguments, but why are they trying to bite our style? We're the ones. But the thing about arguments is, you know, the reason why I'm like, yeah, fuck it, let's read right-wingers, because I love the idea of making myself slip into them, but I can only do that because I don't think there are going to be political effects of those arguments carrying through, just seeing their internal unity. But at the same time, it is not just about analyzing arguments in isolation. It is clearly we are trying to grasp something, do something in the world, and I think philosophy, we can get kind of drunk on that the mere analysis, what you know Gilly just called the sort of a hermeneutical interpretation, that seems to be that's our thing. And it just strikes me as it misunderstands our own sort of historical tendency, but it is something that can drive a wedge and cause a constant drift away from not just political practice in a sort of spontaneous sense, but even political explanation, examination, etc., when all that matters is the argument. Don't get me wrong, arguments are cool, though.
Yeah, of course.
Concepts are great. Love them. Someone's got to work on them.
To go back to what Lillian said, it does sort of, like Lillian said this in the introduction, like a lot of the times, I think we would be well served as philosophers to just admit that sometimes the things we're working on is philosophy shit, and that's not always the same thing as social and political theory. Listen, I've been spending a lot of time recently reading Solomon Maimon because I'm really fascinated by like the weird way he's like doing skeptical criticism of Kant in the wake of like the First Critique in view of developing a better speculative metaphysical account of the infinite
intellect.
So how does
that make communism?
This doesn't make communism. This does not make any communism.
But and it's maybe you can't have communism without it. I mean, maybe.
No, like, dude, I'm not going to. I'm not going to pretend.
Lenin reading in Switzerland before he went and carried out the October 17th Revolution.
Come on, what was
he reading? He was in the fucking mountains reading the science of logic.
I know he was reading the science of logic
obsessively.
I know there, he was like, the part on the absolute.
But there is a connection. I will figure it out one day between speculative metaphysics and communism. I do believe they're organically linked. One day I will understand it.
I'm rooting for you, man.
Yeah, good luck, brother.
Okay, so I think maybe one thing that I want to add, because I think that's right. Like, there's just not the effects of various kinds of philosophical inquiry are not clear. But I also think that, you know, I think what Owen said before, I think you've said on another episode, which is the kind of imminent political nature of most philosophy up until the most recent professionalization and specialization of that skill. So, like, when Anderson writes in italics that it became obsessed with philosophy, and I was like, he means that literally. Mm-hmm. I think what the italics are meant to indicate, at least to me, I don't know what Anderson thinks, actually. It's meant to indicate an arbitrary narrowing of what that means. Because I think the reason people are attracted to philosophical thought is that it signals a more global kind of grasp of the world or more global intelligence. So, like, the mind of Marx that could, like, synthesize those different strands of thought is not going to be replicated by a Marx specialist later. Mm-hmm. It can only be
That's so true.
Wow, that kind of blew my mind.
Okay, can only be replicated, not in this, you know, not as a replication of the same, but I mean like a new synthesis of something by someone who understands political economy, who understands some other area of thought and something else, and genuinely tries to grab the world through them. Mm-hmm. Like, that's. Mm-hmm. That's what will replicate.
Even if you only get two of them, like, this is what we talked about in the Mike Davis episode. Like, he took political economy and that pamphleteering, like, agitating part of Marx's work and tried to do that kind of work, basically never talking about Marx. And that, to me, is a way more faithful, you know, okay, granted, it doesn't have to deal with the question of philosophy and what the hell its imminent connection is to those things. But that to me is an example of like working in the legacy of working in Marxism, not working on Marxism.
You know what I mean? Right, but this is to Anderson's point, right? Like, this is why Western Marxism can be seen as having gone in the reversing the trajectory of Marx's own thought, right? Marx started out like philosophy, and he's like, we got to settle accounts with Feuerbach, and like, you know, we got to think about like species being an alienation. And then at some point he was like,
got to kill Proudhon.
I got to kill Proudhon, right? And then at some point he was like, actually, I don't need to talk about that shit at all.
First of all, it's 1848. Who gives a fuck about that shit? Like, Europe is on fire.
Just because you just said, Owen, like, yeah, granted, like, Mike Davis's work doesn't have to grapple with the questions of philosophy, but, like, in a way, neither did Marx's when we get to Capital, right? Like, he kind of sets it aside. Yeah. And I think that this is to Anderson's point. Maybe there's something important there.
Maybe the small plea I can give for what could be left of philosophy is, you know,
I can't believe we're answering the question of the show today.
I know. This is the last episode.
And then the show's over, guys.
It's our first meta episode.
Done. But what Anderson is describing is, you know, as academic philosophy, and these figures, they got narrower even as they got more complex with their philosophical concepts. And literally they got narrower because they understood literally their own contemporaries less and less. But it seems to me that one of the promises of philosophy, at least in principle, is this notion of totality. And when philosophy kind of gave up on that concept, to say it's too ambitious, it's totalitarian, all that matters are specific arguments and all of that. I mean, you know, there's a way of thinking of totality in the ideal sense of as if, like, I'm going to know everything. Or you could think of totality in the way that, you know, you look at what Marx is doing, which is bringing richer and richer determinations together, responding to his historical moment, and, you know, recouping that in a theory that's alive and well. And philosophy kind of has this promise of you could understand the world. The world can, you know, be brought into it. But once you give up on that ambition, I mean, what has philosophy become? And I think we start to see
what's left
what
of it
looks like.
Yeah.
Like philosophy, can't be done in the mid-range. Not really. You know, like,
yeah.
Like we started with Plato and Aristotle. You can't do that shit in the mid-range.
They're narrow figures. They don't have high ambitions.
I mean,
with their
maybe
thoughts.
You can choose a section of the big range. You know, you choose an area in the big range, but never losing
it
sight
can
of
be
the
in
fact
a lane.
That you're trying to working in a corner of a social totality that you're trying to conceptually articulate.
To be clear, what you're working in the corner of is a little corner of the absolute.
That's
not forget.
Going to say dynamic totality. You can say it's, well, I don't know, you could say it's like social economic life, or it's the absolute, you know, depending on what your persuasion is.
Yeah. But it's just like, it's fascinating what happens even to theory. It's not just theories cut off from practice. Because I think the thing is, actually, philosophers, we do still engage in practice. Just like, you're probably not going to like the practices we engage in, which is disciplining one another, lots of meetings, you know, all of that. Yeah, those are practices.
Trying to sound smart at parties.
Time in that practice. But when you give up on, you know, responding to the world in its real essential relations, you can see it's not, again, like, I don't think Anderson is blaming Sartre and all of that, but that does wound the very project of Marxism. And when philosophy withdrew from that, it does start to become this thing that represses its political urges or tries to pretend that, no, this really small thing I'm doing, no, that's actually revolutionary, if you look at it correctly. And so this is just me saying, philosophy, embrace the totality again.
That's our program.
I just want to, like, really fast, like, echo that and say that this is, like, why, again, I think Adorno is the apex or the nadir, I guess, of Western Marxism, as Anderson describes it. Both. Like, when he quotes him towards the end of the chapter on formal shifts, and he's like, here's Adorno. Theory is a form of practice, and practice itself is an eminently theoretical concept, end quote. And Anderson comments, the defiant theoreticism of these pronouncements, effectively suppressing the whole material problem of the unity of theory and practice as a dynamic bond between Marxism and the mass revolutionary struggle, right, is just like the characteristic general motto of Western Marxism in the epoch after the Second World War. Like, come on, man. In fact, the articulation of theory and practice is a problem. Mm-hmm. You can't just say, oh, theory is practice and practice is theoretical. Like, done. Nailed it.
Yeah, then I'm just doing practice when I write at my
computer. Just doing practice right now. Yeah, don't worry about it.
That's such a cool thing to say when, like, the dude had at best aloofness towards practice and at worst just like total scorn. Like, so
yeah,
but somehow sought to unify them on the theoretical side.
That's not idealism.
Someday we gotta do an episode on Adorno's marginalia, the theory and praxis. But yeah, it is crazy, and you get the rich pessimism there where he's just like, unfortunately, practice isn't possible at the moment, so the best we can do is theory holding itself to account and examining itself.
Man, he's got such drag of Adorno in there. He's like, because, you know, he's describing the process of moving the Frankfurt School to the United States, right? When it was moved to New York. And he's like, now it's embedded and it's totally detached at this point from, like, any working class movements, any working class
struggle. Because there was none in the U.S. at the time.
Yeah, and he talks about how, like, him and Adorno and Horkheimer ended up, like, they adapted very well to their new milieu, as he puts it, like, basically, like, conservatism, apoliticism, don't say a single word about socialism. And then he says, but it gets even worse. Then they go back to Germany, and it's West Germany after the war, where, like, the Communist Party is outlawed. Like, there's working, like, you know, the left is basically becomes illegal because it's overseen by the Americans and the British. He said it kind of corrupted Horkheimer a little bit. He started doing, like, weird apologias for, like, capitalism. But Adorno actually wasn't really that affected because he never gave a shit about any politics or practice anyways. So he almost is like this weird underhanded dig where he's like, Adorno's thoughts on politics weren't affected because he doesn't have any.
Because he didn't have any.
That's a great joke.
Like, that's my king right there.
Got his ass.
That I think is a little maybe metapolitical that I've noticed about the way, like, Europeans relate to their own working classes, and that I guess this text helped me to think about, like, just a little bit. So before I say this, middle-class Americans likewise hate their own working classes, like, or like North Americans do. I think the issue that what makes it different is that they also deny that they have a class structure. So everyone gets to talk about their bootstraps. Mm-hmm. And everybody gets to act like they came from humble beginnings and so on and so forth. Like, and there's a mass culture that, like, kind of denies the obvious strength of class divisions in the United States. And I think in North America as a whole.
Everyone self-reports as middle class, regardless of where you are in like stratification.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Billionaires, yeah. And
what I've noticed is that European like middle class radicals have a genuine hostility to their own working classes in a way that I find a little, this is a generalization, you know, if European listeners want to push back, it fine. I'm just saying like the strands of radicalism in Europe that I am aware of that are kind of further afield from like more like Marxian cohorts, but also in that milieu as well, have a real antagonism to their own working classes as being failures of living too large, of not living up to their cultural expectations. Hmm. And I think that like the intellectual world that was inherited from this kind of divorce with socialist tradition and practice has unfortunately like enabled this, because people get to continue to call themselves radicals and socialists and actually hate their constituency. I find this extremely troubling, you know, like, and I'm not like, it's kind of funny, but it's actually like not funny when you think about it, that like you start to realize that like the traditional socialist base is perceived as mostly the problem by middle-class radicals. And it has to be that you don't have any actual political experience outside of a middle-class milieu that can make you think that.
Hmm.
I guess maybe I kind of want to, like, these are maybe my more concluding thoughts about this essay is like becoming more, like, it's a self-indulgent to talk about, like, what are philosophers doing and so on, but there's more of a meta point about thinking about how to relate to a constituency that you identify with or that want to identify with, because all of the people of the classical tradition were middle-class people, except for Gramsci and a couple others. But they were in a life world where they understood, and I've said this on previous episodes, that when the right gained votes, they showed up to the meeting, the party meeting, and were like, what did we do wrong? Mm-hmm. They were fanatics.
Yes.
You know, there were fanatics about this. And we don't have that. We have fanatics about whether or not they, people are perceived to be good people by other people.
Why are working class people so dumb and
why are they so dumb?
Yeah.
And I am, you know, I started calling this in my work recently like a Manichaean way of thinking about class politics, where like people mostly deserve the support of morally good middle class people when they are also morally good. And if they seem to be doing something objectionable, or they might be like a little right wing or mixed politics, like there's some reacts, you smell some reactionary elements, that can't be the real working class. That's not your base. So this, and this is at the discretion of people who theorize and then get to choose. And I think a big difference with like the classical tradition is that those middle class intellectuals, they didn't get to choose their base. They realized that they had to fight for it because that's what the movement was doing.
Oh, well, that's what mass politics requires. You can't have mass politics with such a discriminating attitude towards your constituency.
Exactly. That's it. I think the difference, and I think what we've now realized is like the decline of mass politics, that maybe in 1976 was like not what Anderson was calling it at the time. I think like that's what he was seeing happening, like the collapse of that.
My concluding question is, the thing that I like that philosophy constantly provokes me to do is, you know, when people say things, I ask, what do they mean by that? And so what I mean is, you know, clearly the outcome of this is theory, at least the type of theory that you want to engage in that, you know, tries to understand and change the world, when it's severed from practice, let's just say it goes through mutations. Like, you know, I think, you know, some things that like Althusser and all of them did were really rich and interesting. I think the concept of overdetermination, very provocative. But, you know, a lot of people keep saying the thing that, you know, Marx took to be a problem to be solved rather than assume that it would happen, which is the relationship between theory and practice. And it seems to me that that is a relation that has to constantly be rethought of how, what that's going to look like. And I think, you know, what the Anderson left with the question is two questions. One, what would it have looked like for these figures that he's analyzing to try to actually solve that problem again? And I think that's a really hard counterfactual question. In some ways, the way Anderson's describing it is like these were figures, these were men who were, you know, kind of subject to the historical conditions that they themselves were not the product mm-hmm. of. But then I think the question is, what would theory and practice look like for us today? Those of us reflecting on this, reflecting on these historical failures, reflecting on the distortion of philosophy, its turn against, you know, the type of base it claims to want to speak for and all of that. And I'm just wondering what it could look like for philosophy, even if philosophy isn't the head or anything like that, for it to actually resume that connection between theory and practice. Does that only happen by maybe that's work that we do when we're not professional philosophers? Is that, you know, us taking Hegel's Science of Logic and going down to the labor union meeting and being like, let's also discuss this? Like, you know, I'm kind of joking, but I'm kind of serious. Like, you know, the thing about Marx's method that I really love is not just the totality, it's the historicality of it. That, you know, you can't just rest on your laurels. You have to re-win what these social conditions are, what they demand of us. And I find myself not knowing exactly the answer to the question of what the link between theory and praxis looks like in the wake of these generations of defeat, perhaps a resurgent labor union, but nowhere near the heights. What could it look like? And I don't think that there's an easy answer. I'm just saying, you know, no. That's just like a question, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to end here maybe in like following up on that by sharing with you guys a couple of lines from the last chapter before the afterword from the book, because he quotes Lenin. He says, I'm going to give Lenin the last word, so I'm giving Anderson the last word on Lenin, whatever. The quote from Lenin is, quote, correct revolutionary theory assumes final shape only in close connection with the practical activity of a truly mass and truly revolutionary movement. And then he says, that's five conditions, right? Like, you could do revolutionary theory by yourself, even in the academy, presumably. But that revolutionary theory won't assume a, quote, correct and final form unless it's in close connection with a mass movement that is itself revolutionary. So even if you're like, you know, go down to the shop, but there are a bunch of reformists, like, that's still not going to like make it possible for you to do correct and true final form revolutionary theory. Yeah. And he says those five conditions just have been lacking. But, you know, he's like, maybe there's a chance that they're coming back, that those conditions could be met. But then he ends by saying, when a truly revolutionary movement is born in a mature working class, the final shape of theory will have no exact precedent. All that can be said is that when the masses themselves speak, theoreticians of the sort the West has produced for 50 years will necessarily be silent. And I think that's probably true. That sounds right to me.
That's fair. That's fine.
That does it for us today. New episodes of What's Left of Philosophy come out every 2 weeks wherever you get your podcasts. Also, check us out on YouTube for videos and live streams. Before closing out today, we'd like to take a minute to thank some of the people who are supporting the show on Patreon. We couldn't do this without you, and we're really grateful. Today's new patrons are Kieran Simpson, Menik Mati, Lewis, Dan B., Isaac Villegas, Christopher Page, John B.H., Jack Robertson, Lefteris Damalos, Ben Van de Ende, David Court, Matthias David Lozano, Julia Michael Wiest, Rachel Katz, Sam Ray, Ryan Wanamaker, Hafia, Jack Meyer, Joe Clement, Sirniak Left. Thank you all very much. If you too like what we're doing and want to support the show, please go to our website, leftofphilosophy.com, and click the support button. Patrons get access to exclusive content like locked episodes, bonus videos, and access to our Discord server. You can also buy some What's Left of Philosophy merch from the store linked on our website. Follow us on Twitter at @leftofphil, and don't forget to leave us good reviews and comments on your podcast app. With that, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.